Today's episode of the Inside EVs podcast is brought to you by E-Range EV Tyre. E-Range EV tyres are specifically engineered for electric vehicles. Using an advanced manufacturing process called liquid phase mixing, E-Range EV's EcoPoint 3 technology creates a tyre with lower rolling resistance and longer range, while offering low levels of wear and high grip. All this while staying affordable. Go to erangetyres.com. That's E-R-A-N-G-E-Tyres.com to find your EV's next set of tyres.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good whatever time of day it is, wherever you are and you're listening to this. It's Friday, which means it's the Inside EVs podcast day. As ever, I'm your host, Alex Goy, and we are joined by Misco Electric, Lacey. Hi, Lacey. How are you rolling?
Good day. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. The boss man, Patrick George. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good. Nice sweater, Alex. Those who aren't watching this on video, Alex and I both did the, you know, like Saab owner black sweater thing today. And,
I've got thin black glasses. I've got a roll neck. I either look like I want to buy a Saab or I'm going to present you with a new iPhone.
Yeah.
And last but not least, we have Hazel Southwell, who has something to tell us about Jaguar Land Rover and bongs. Not those kind of bongs. Mine's out of the gutter. So before we jump to the news, hello, Hazel. How are you? Tell us your wonderful tales.
I'm all right. Yes, this was something I was literally just reading before we started the podcast, but something that we talk about quite a lot on this and generally within electric vehicle spaces is the increasing complexity of the amount of information that drivers are being fed, especially the methods that they're being fed it, whether that's on an infotainment screen or a heads-up display or like whatever. And something really cool and genuinely useful and the kind of thing that is going to meaningfully improve both road safety and like the driving experience is that the University of Cambridge have done a study into being able to, where they've developed a framework that can detect and predict whether a driver is likely to need their full concentration or whether it's a good time to be like, hey, by the way, there's a thing. And that can then be kind of fed into infotainment systems. And so it's like, whether the screen is essentially dark because it's like you're driving in the rain, it's dark, there's a lot of traffic around you, so this is not a good time for anything to be coming up, or whether there's other kind of like moments where, for instance, you're sitting at a traffic light and it's your regular commute, and so you could reasonably be expected to be able to cope with a bit of extra information and things like that. They did it in partnership with JLR. Obviously, this is sort of like fresh at the research stage, so I don't know exactly what implementations it could have yet, but it does appear to be a piece of software or an algorithm that could actually be rolled out pretty much immediately. So that's a good thing.
That's a very, very good thing, because I don't know if any of you guys have driven a high-end Hyundai product recently. They like a good bong. All they do is bong or flash things at you or tell you that you're about to have some sort of world-ending cataclysmic accident where actually you've just wandered 1 mile an hour over the speed limit, or the speed limit has changed, or you wandered over it while the speed limit is changing. So then you get all the bongs, or someone looked at you funny because it doesn't like that, so it'll bong at you. So this is fantastic news. I just need it to be sent to Korea immediately.
Yeah, I had a Genesis GV60 I was testing earlier this year, which I love. I adore that car inside and out. But I'd had this like speed camera warning thing that I could not turn off. I just, for the life of me, could not figure out how to do it, even after repeated Googling. And it's like, I live in New York City. There are speed cameras everywhere. Like, I know this. Like, and I'm not speeding. Like, please, like, stop yelling at me that there's a camera around. And it tells you that. And I think highlighting the Koreans is an interesting one, just because like that, I've driven in that country. They are so crazy about road safety and low speed limits and speed cameras. that translates into the cars. And I think, I guess they dial that back for like Americans and Europeans, but it's still a little aggro at times. And like, it's just, yeah, just trust people to drive at some point, you know, or
yes, please.
Ease off. Yeah, please. Yeah,
We're grown-ups. It make the test, if you want to do it, make the tests harder and more involved and yeah. Let us be grown-ups and have our own accidents.
They wouldn't give a car to just anybody, right?
But I mean, there's also, for instance, like meaningful information, like, do you need to know if you're driving at night in the rain and you need to focus on the road? Like, you know, Alex and I live in London and people drive in really weird ways on the M25, including like big rig trucks literally overtaking each other in the fast lane and stuff. And especially when it's wet, it gets like really hairy. That is exactly the moment. I do not need to know that the car is running at an efficiency of 1.2 kilowatt hours per whatever, like, or any of this information that somebody appears like that. I don't need that. I need the screen to effectively be dark unless there's something it actually has to tell me so I can concentrate on what I need to look at.
So it's essentially an algorithmic version of a very jumper appropriate feature. Back in the day, Saabs used to have night mode. Everything's a bit busy. You press the night mode button and everything goes off apart from the speedo. And even then, not all of it. So I like it. I like it a lot. That is excellent news. Right. So without further ado, should we jump on to actual EV news?
EV news.
Right, other than Cambridge University and Jaguar Land Rover making our lives infinitely better, lots has happened. Let's kick off with a Tesla Model S that has done 1.2 million miles. Big asterisk on it, but we're going to talk about that in a minute. So 1.2 million miles. It's been the miles have been racked up by the fabulous named Hans-Jörg von Gemmingen Hornberg. I love his name already. He is fantastic. He's got a 2014 Model S P85. I remember when those came out. Those were the really good one. It's picked up officially 1.18 million miles. So as Eric says in the story, about 131,000 miles a year, which is insane. Now, I say this has done 1.2 million miles. Not all of it has done 1.2 million miles. So it's on its fourth battery, and it's on its 14th rear motor, which means some of it made the journey, like the body and the glass and the wheels and the seats, but not some of the bits that actually make it be a car, basically. What do we think, friends? I think it's fantastic.
14?
Yeah. So in the story, Eric kind of goes on to explain that it's had 14 batteries because Model S's of that era, apparently the rear motor had something funky with it. So a lot of these have been a lot of them have been refurbed and not really fixed properly. But yes, it's a thing.
1.2 million miles on any car is amazing that he did.
Yeah.
This is really remarkable. You know, just full stop, you know?
Yeah, I think there's like a Volvo that's like known for that, isn't there? Like over a million mile of Volvo.
I think it's a P1800, if you will allow me to have a look. I think it's a Volvo P1800. Chat amongst yourselves. We'll be back in a minute.
Yeah, I think you're right. It was that one gentleman. I think he bought it in the 70s and just drove it for half a century. So this guy did that in, 7
not
years?
Not even 10 years, yeah.
Yeah, amazing, you know?
Because
most cars don't reach this level of mileage because most cars do not have a lifetime where the average mileage will get anything close to this. So this guy does drive this car like an abnormal amount.
He does. I mean, 131,000 miles in a year is mad. I mean, we all drive a bit for work, but not 131,000 miles. I mean, that's to borrow a quote from Clarkson, that's not a carbon footprint, that's a snowshoe. But he has said, Gemmingen Hornberg notes that he does take it easy in his Model S. He does not drive the car for long distances without giving it and himself a break. He only covers 62 miles at a time before pausing for a while. So does he just get up and drive?
Like 24 hours?
Yeah. And then he sort of does a very slow route around and then goes home and goes, right, well, that was a great day's driving. Don't know about you guys, but I need a nap.
Well, I was thinking, like, this guy probably had to do a lot of DC fast charging if he's gotten that many miles in that amount of time. And it says the fourth battery pack. Like, yeah, I got to imagine. I don't know. I'd be interested in hearing it. Is it in the article that he DC fast charged? Like, what was his charging profile looking like?
He only covers about 60 miles per hour. And then in regards to depleting and charging the battery, he says he aims to recharge it when it drops down to 20%. Doesn't fully deplete it and doesn't top it off. That's what we've got in the story. So I, by the sounds of things, he just 80% it and then kind of drops down like a sensible. But I think it's mega. And that, yeah, it was a Volvo P1800. It hasn't just done a million miles. It's done 3.2 million miles. That's a lot of miles.
Oh my god!
Like,
who is driving this much? This is unbelievable.
What do they do for a job?
If it's not rideshare driving, I mean, like that's yeah. I maybe get, but like how much time do you spend in the car? Like, do you go outside and feel some sunshine ever? You know, the grass, the wind on your face. Like, you know, highly recommended from time to time.
If I need to do that, I roll down the window of my Volvo.
And I feel the wind in my beard. Well, I mean, our Hans Jorg does look like he does an exercise. Like, he doesn't just sit in his car all day. He
does say in the article that quite a lot of the mileage is from like mega road trips. So he's driven from, I'm not sure where he's based, I kind of assume it's Norway, to like Morocco and kind of done big overland trips in these in his car. So yeah, presumably some of this is in relatively concentrated bursts.
Yeah, but only 62 miles at a time, which is mega. Anyway, I love him. He wins all of the points from me for purely just for sticking with it. Oh, another thing to note, he did have an original Tesla Roadster, which he did over 400,000 miles in. And he swapped it for his used Model S because it was bigger and offered him more space.
We're dealing with somebody on a different level with this guy.
Dude needs a statue.
There's EV drivers, and then there's this guy. He's you know, he's something else. He's playing a different game than the rest of us, you know.
He's a legend.
He's a legend in his own lifetime. Anyway.
14 rear motors though.
So in the piece it does say that some of them might have been used or refurbed, hence the fragility of them. Also, and this is where one of those things, I saw this story the other day. If you're British, you will understand the phrase "Trigger's Broom." If you watched WandaVision, you will understand the ship of Theseus, or no, you know, Greek mythology.
Yes.
There's a whole thing in a British sitcom called Only Fools and Horses. It's aged terribly, but one of the more famous bits is that Trigger is a street cleaner, and he was awarded for his incredible work, and he orates about how wonderful his broom is and how incredible it's been. And he goes, "That's the original broom you've had for years." He went, "Oh no, it's on its fifth head and its fourth handle." So yes, it is the same car.
I was going to say, how much of this car is actually the same aside from the odometer? But presumably, I mean, the chassis must be, you know, cracked.
Yeah, it's just those bits. So, like, fair play. It is a bit of a Trigger's Broom situation, but it is awesome that he's done it. So fair play to you. Anyway, on to more Tesla news. After last week's Tesla Cybertruck Power Hour, which I thought we'd gotten away with having not to talk about the motorized oblong anymore, but no, or rhombus, I guess it is. It's back. So Tesla wants Cybertruck reservation holders to pay lots and lots and lots and lots of money. Basically, if you want your car now, you buy a Foundation Series car. It starts at $120,000 US. But you do get lots of bits, so you get a laser etched badges, and you get lots of toys, and full self-driving, which apparently. yes. But it's so I found it the Foundation series itself is named after the Foundation series by Isaac Asimov. And it's where one man gets in the basically saves the universe because he's so awesome. Do we think
I wonder who that could be? Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder. Do you think he sees himself in this character and how he's going to save the world from cars that aren't really, really ugly?
Aren't that's a bit indestructible, right? Yeah.
Undestructible.
It's a bit egotistical. Why would he think that? Why would anyone? That can't be right.
Strange.
very strange man. But yeah, here we are. In the wonderful piece, the Foundation series books tell the story of a galactic empire that is about to collapse. One person tries to prevent this collapse. In the bin with that. But yes, you get limited edition laser etched badging, premium accessories, charging equipment with power share, home backup hardware, all terrain tires, FSD, and more. And people have been going for it. Like there are people on the internet basically going, "Oh, I've just spent £140,000 on my car. Isn't that great? Dollars on my car. Isn't that great?" What do we think, friends?
I mean, for that crowd, that early adopter crowd, I believe a fully optioned Cybertruck, you know, check all the boxes. You're going north of 100 anyway. I could definitely see that sort of like very wealthy, maybe even car collector, definitely tech bro crowd. Like, yeah, you know, what's another 10 grand, 20 grand for this, for the Foundation series? So like, I was actually out of the office on a drive this week when they published that story, and I read that headline. I was like, is he asking for an extra $120,000 to get your car early? Which I could also see happening. But no, it's like, I don't want to say it's a reasonable price for this. I'm like, yeah, for what you're getting and for the audience, like, I think it makes sense. I'm probably not going to buy one, but good for people who do.
Oh, yeah. In a tweet in the story from at @DennisCW_, breaking Tesla Cybertruck Founder Edition, Beast Mode Edition, lots of editions there. Price $119,990, destination fee $1,995, license $792, registration $582, tax $11,558.58. The total is just shy of $135,000. So yeah, it's I guess they want to get the big bucks in immediately and like take advantage of the hype.
I think so. I think that, you know, and especially I feel strongly that the all-wheel drive dual motor version is going to be the one that everyone pretty much goes for, but there will still be some people that want the tri-motor. And I think this is an added benefit of like, here, let's push this tri-motor. Let's get top dollar for it so we can make some money back on this massive undertaking of all the new stuff that we've brought in, R&D, everything regarding this product, because it's not going to make money for a long time. But if we can recoup as much as possible, I love the fact that they're providing the power sharing capability with the hardware that comes with it, because, you know, Lightning upper trims came with the 80 amp pro onboard or the pro charger that you could have the bi-directional charging at your home as well. So I feel like they needed to sweeten the deal somehow. So it makes sense that they would include FSD and the power sharing capability here.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense. So someone in the comments, apologies if I completely butcher your name, Mercia, has said, have you checked the prices of Range Rovers? Fair. They are really, really expensive. But having seen it, the interior of a Range Rover is a vastly different place from an interior of a Cybertruck, right? Like if we're going to have that conversation, we're comparing to
a Range Rover or a Cybertruck are both status symbol objects. They're just different types of status symbol. You know, a Range Rover is saying that you're rich enough to have old money in the UK. and the Cybertruck is saying that, you invest in creative fintech startups in the US. I think for this, it doesn't really matter what you could put any price tag on a Cybertruck and people would be buying them because people want to buy them. I don't know why he's dragging Asimov into this, like, to be honest.
Because only one man can save a giant empire from falling, and apparently it's Elon Musk. I'm not sure if it made it onto my microphone, but that I think was the loudest eye roll I've ever done.
I heard it from here in New York.
Yeah.
I'm not. Well, I don't know. Anyway, they. I don't think he's read the books. I'll say it like that. There's a lot of them, and they're quite long, so you know, it would take a while. But anyway, I don't think this really matters. I mean, like, at the end of the day, prices of EVs, especially luxury EVs, which this is, are astronomical. You know, you have things like the iX coming out with well north of $100,000 price tag and stuff, and this is much more of a like cultural moment thing. I actually kind of think, and I was thinking a little bit about this after the show last week, but I do wonder how much it matters for Tesla to get these early deliveries, get people to pay for these early deliveries, and get quite a lot of them out, because these might be the only ones they ever sell.
Ooh.
For this year?
I'm not sure I fully agree with that. Like, I think that, yeah, like this right now, these early ones, this is Tesla's supercar. But like, once they get these things moving, like, we can say what we want about the design. I do think if they can get production dialed in, I think they're going to sell almost everyone they make. Like, I think so too. Yeah.
I think they will, but not at this kind of price point. So, these will be the only kind of like over 100,000 Cybertrucks, and then it has to come down for it to realistically.
Yeah, I mean, if we loop back to last week's podcast, you know, the price of the rear drive car is less than half of this. but with that, I guess you get a really sparse interior and really flat paint. Oh,
but you still get the shape. You still get a Cybertruck. Yeah. So like these are going to be like the ultra high end Curios that will eventually end up in, you know, Detroit museums, annoying GM and whatever.
I saw that they're going to be delivering to Texas and California. It looks like those are the only two states for the rest of this year, as far as I understand from what I've read, which is understandable because they have facilities there that they'd be able to service fairly easy if something does go sideways. And I got to imagine things are going to go sideways with this being so new and having so many different things in there that they've done for the first time. So that was somewhat, I don't know, I was kind of sad, but understood it. But I do think that this is going to be a very slow ramp of production.
Mm. Mm.
Just based on all the videos that I've watched so far. I know Sandy sat down with Elon and he was basically tempering it again. And a lot of stuff that I've watched so far seems like this is going to be a really, really slow ramp.
Yeah, that's interesting too. It's like, you know, say what you want. There's a lot you could say about Musk at this point, certainly, but it's like, I think him being kind of like managing expectations feels a bit new in some ways.
Yes.
Like that's not a thing, you know, he is a human hype machine with everything he does, with AI, with space, with human consciousness in the future and all that. But with this one thing, I think he's like, yeah, so we're working on it and like be patient. And that's kind of a rare thing for him. I feel like that says a lot.
That's bordering on humility and honesty.
Also, speaking of humility, I thought it was awesome. I saw Jim Farley retweet the fact that you know how Jason Kamisa's video was like, oh, he sent this document to all the automakers that said this is how you do a 48-volt architecture for the low voltage system. And Jim Farley was like, yeah, actually, we did get that document. Thanks, Elon. I was like, oh, okay.
Hand it to Farley, too, because he's also the guy that kicked off you know, all of the automakers going to Tesla's NACS plug. Like, they made that public, and Farley at Ford was the first one to be like, yeah, screw it. We're all, like, all the Fords are going to go to NACS the next 2 years. And in America, like literally every automaker, except I think Volkswagen at this point, is basically following the exact same pattern. So it's not even, I don't say if you can't beat them, join them kind of thing with Ford, but like I think they're being tactically smart. It's like, hey, if you're going to put this technology out there, like we're going to use it because why wouldn't we? And that's a wise move, you know?
Developing something to compete with it or something that doesn't work with a massive network of chargers, it's it's a good way to spend lots of money and not be as good or useful. That's a good. But yes,
Volkswagen really fascinate me on that one. Like, I know there's like we could do several episodes dedicated to like what is going on in the VW group. It's another thing where like I want to now like behind the scenes, the office sort of like Drive to Survive style programs about automakers. One was like the early days of Stellantis. I still think that would have ripped. And like now with like Jeep and Citroën kind of like looking at each other across the table, like, who are you?
What do you do?
I want the Nissan Mitsubishi Renault Alliance.
Yeah. I mean, like, basically any of these weird conglomerates where they're all like infighting and whatever. But Volkswagen in particular, because Volkswagen is like a well-established group. This is not like something where there's tension between like Audi and Porsche have never met or like whatever. But the series of decisions that it's been making like strategically as an overall group, particularly in the last like 12 months, are, I would say, like quite... Maybe there is something in background where it will all turn out to be part of like a fabulous plan. But it certainly doesn't seem immediately kind of like coherent.
Yeah. For those just joining us, like would hate if, you know, or if you're new to this world, which is, you know, an audience we aim for a lot of these days at Inside EVs, it's like Volkswagen Group, which Hazel's saying, you know, they were the first automaker to announce like, we're going all electric. We're going to kick that off. And it was largely in part for penance for their diesel cheating. And it's been kind of a disaster this year in particular, but
I mean, that's
all of it in general, like lots of delays, software problems. I don't think the ID.4 has been this game changer they wanted it to be. I don't think the ID.3 was in Europe. Like the demand's not been great. And like, you know, we don't get this.
And supply is even worse than demand.
Yeah, totally. And like, we don't get this as much in America because like they're a decent brand here, but like in Europe and elsewhere, it's like Volkswagen like makes all of the cars. They make all of the cars like in Europe.
I mean,
and
to put that into context, like there's the saying that everyone has an experience with a Ford. Everyone has an experience with a Golf.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Everyone's been in near or around a Golf at some point in their life. Like here, they are everywhere. If I looked out of my window for 30 seconds, a Golf or a Polo would probably roll on by. Like they're everywhere.
Yeah, like that's true of like, you know, and all the brands they have, you know, Seat and Skoda and Audi and everything. And they're kind of looking at this future they know to be electric and they're not getting it right. And they're like, what the shit do we do? Like, what is going on here? And it's, you know, like when I was before I came to Inside EVs and I was a freelance reporter, like I had a lot of great sources at Caria, their in-house software division, but they keep getting laid off. So I don't know who to talk to there anymore. So it's not going well, their software electric transformation.
There is one Volkswagen EV that's actually doing really well. And it's not the VW ID.3, but it's the Cupra Born, which is the same car. Like if you put them side by side,
looks cool.
They are
identical. It's the same car, but the Cupra Born is like sexy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like it's like
it is.
Like the ID.4 is like
soft, squishy, pulky.
Yeah, and yeah. It's boring. The Cupra Born, it is just the same car.
Yeah.
But like with lipstick on.
and a cool tribal tattoo logo.
And is it cheaper? Is the Cupra Born cheaper than an ID.3 in Europe though?
If you give me 2 minutes, I think it's about the same price.
It's definitely it's not off-puttingly more expensive.
Interesting. Yeah.
One of the comments here says the VW group was forced too early into EVs because of compliance reasons. But I honestly think it was an opportunity and they squandered it. That's how I see it, is that it was an opportunity to them be forced into it. And it's not just Volkswagen. It's the whole group. It's Electrify America. It's even Audi. Like this whole weird thing of like we're going electric, and then like even just the next generation of the Q8, which is taking the place of the e-tron, is like marginally different. Like they have the opportunity to make big strides. And I mean, the Taycan was great. Like,
yeah.
What happened? Like, can you guys like what's going on?
But the thing with Q8 is it drives really nicely, but it's woefully inefficient. Like, you'll struggle to get 2 miles per kilowatt hour out of it.
So from what I understand, and Hazel, I definitely want you to speak more of the battery side of this, because you know way more than I do. But like on the software side, like that's one of the big areas they're failing. Yeah. And it's from what I understand, VW Group used to do it like about a decade ago, did all their software like almost brand to brand, or like groups of brands. Like you had like Audi, Porsche doing their own thing on software, Volkswagen doing their own thing, and so on. And then they decided to consolidate, and then they decided to build all the software from the ground up instead. And instead of like using off the shelf stuff, apparently, and I guess sort of reorganizing to be like this centralized software company from what they did before, is really not working out. And they're just not getting it right. That software, I think you know more about batteries than I would. Here.
I mean, in both instances, I mean, the software, so you can have a relatively naff battery, but if you're managing it well in terms of software and recovery and stuff, then you could have like a very efficient car relative to anything. And that's something that actually like the Renault Mitsubishi Nissan Alliance, actually they have a fairly good grip on. But the problem that you're seeing with, and yeah, it's kind of everything that everyone said, in that they dashed out like 6 e-trons in a year. Like there was a point where when I was last working with Patrick, there just seemed to be a new e-tron every week. And I was like, is this a new one? Oh, yes, it is. Okay, I guess I have to write up a new, larger e-tron. And every e-tron was larger and kind of more boring. But they literally released like 6 in a year. And they kind of made these platforms, or they made initially a platform that maybe wasn't good enough. Then they tried to make another one, and all of them, you could put together the best battery package in the world, and if the software is not there to manage it, then it will be completely useless. It will be like a sink of huge amounts of expenditure and carbon to really get nothing out of it. I don't think there's anything particularly naff about the architecture that the VW Group is using for its batteries. They're not like particularly low quality or low density or anything like that. It's just that despite, and this does confuse me, because the VW Group have been in electric racing for a long time. Please excuse my cat. She also is confused by VW Group.
She's pissed off.
I wish to give her worship from afar.
A lot of groups like JLR have managed to get this like meaningful efficiency gain from looking at like high stress motorsport applications, and they still haven't, even though they had 2 teams in Formula E at one point, and like that genuinely is for the software side of it a huge research bed, but it's all, they can't seem to get that racing technology back into, and of course they were in WEC when it was hybrid as well. The World Endurance Championship, Le Mans, nothing seems to connect anymore. Like they decided they were going to synergize all their software into this one unit, and then repeatedly fragmented that until it seems even less coherent than before.
I will say, I saw interesting news last week, I think it was, that Volkswagen was working with XPeng, and they put another like certain amount of money into their company, which, you know, this is for like a Chinese product, but still it's like, okay, if you have access to or partnerships with these companies that are good on the software front, like I'm not pronouncing it right, so I apologize, but XPeng, if you know that Chinese brand, you know, their cars are great and their software is great, like either leverage something like that, maybe, I don't know, or maybe just go the Google route like everyone else is going or something. I don't know. Just fix it.
It's just, we see different versions of this across the board. And it's, I mean, like with every car company, from the startups to the, you know, so-called like legacy or established automakers, like this is a really hard transition to batteries and software. I think all of them were like, how hard could it be? We've made cars for a century. And it turns out the answer is like really freaking hard. And the startups have their problems. Rivian and Lucid have their problems. And also General Motors and Ford and Volkswagen have their problems doing this. So it's we're kind of in the giant headache era of this whole thing. And it's like, I don't know. It's going to be really fascinating to see how the dust settles in like 10 years. One that seems to be having it, getting it together, though, interestingly enough, to transition, is BYD out of China. Ooh. And
that was a beautiful set, like, well done.
Just, yeah, thank you. Thank you. I've been preparing for it for weeks. I'm really proud of my work today. But the big news, and not to put on my Alex Goy hat for a second, the big news is that the BYD Seal sedan is now on sale in Mexico, which is North America, which is just south of Texas. And that is one of the best and I think coolest looking probably Tesla Model 3 competitors anyone's ever built, and it's really, really high tech, and the range is great, and it is on our continent now, so you know that ought to freak people out. I think, you know,
it's hot. As soon as one is available in the UK, I shall be diving into it. If it's
really ready.
In which case, what I meant to say was I shall ring BYD's PR team and see when I can borrow one.
I thought you had one on order, but I was like, no, yeah, but either way, you know.
No, I have to fix other broken vehicles first. But that is hot. So you'll have to excuse my ignorance because I don't live in America. What's to stop someone from nipping over the border, buying a BYD and take it into the US? Is it still show and display laws or?
Yeah, you wouldn't be able to register it here. Like, you see a good amount of like Mexican cars on Mexican plates in the United States in various places that are just here, you know, temporarily or whatever. But it's like you can't just like go into Mexico and buy a Mexican car and register it in the United States for all kinds of VIN number reasons and DMV reasons, Department of Motor Vehicle registration reasons and stuff. But the fact is that if they're here, BYD's eyeing a factory in Mexico, which would probably get them around the 30% tariffs we have on Chinese cars. So like it's this thing's here, and it's I think it's a matter of time before it shows up, you know, stateside for sale if in Europe, you know.
Yeah, I mean, looking at the pricing, it's what 50. It's comparable to the Model 3, or little undercuts it neatly. You've got a rear drive car with 201 horsepower, 61 kilowatt hour battery, LFP battery, 285 mile range, an all wheel drive car with obviously all the power in the world, more range because it's got a bigger battery, and it's cool. The thing about, you know, the Chinese businesses, you can accuse them of having been quite, should we say, lazy with design. And just being like, here is a generic slab of car. The technology is amazing. But whereas this, it looks really cool. And it's got like little hint. There's little hints of things you'll know. So like the headlights there are a bit Ferrari SF90. And I'm seeing a bit of Panamera on the rear three quarter.
But it's baby like Panamera, Taycan vibes. And I'm like, I'm here for it. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say this is a Taycan for like,
Model affordable
rest,
Taycan,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, the rest of us.
Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. So yeah, how long do you reckon it'll be until a BYD finally wears US plates?
Lacey, what do you think?
Tough one. I don't know. I think it's still like a matter of like delicately working with our government. Like, I think, you know what frustrates me so much about this whole transition to EVs is, okay, the government is subsidizing people to buy them, yes. But the main thing that's touted is that, oh, because we want to be green. That's what we're doing. And And I understand the reason why they're doing that. But the real reason that we need these subsidies, especially for legacy automakers, is because this is coming.
Yep.
This is coming, and they will undercut it. And actually, the Chinese, you know, back like, I think it was like a month or something ago, there was some kind of investigation or probe or whatever into the Chinese automakers coming into Europe because the Chinese government was like subsidizing heavily so that they could undercut and get those prices down even further. And that's the thing. They have the government that would do that. So, you know, I think it's a delicate dance right now for them to work with our country. Of course, we have the big tariffs and everything like that, and they wouldn't get subsidies as of right now based on the fact that everything is produced in China. I mean, Mexico, yes, they will be in North America, but as far as like how are they going to achieve getting those battery? Because even some of the, like we saw in this past week in the news, like some trim levels of the Model 3 are not getting some of the subsidy. They're only getting like $3,750 now, moving into the 2024 calendar year. So it'll be interesting to see how they navigate that and if they can lock down, regardless, certain incentives for them to get the price down more. But this is why I'm so nervous about, like, I'm so upset of Legacy Auto being like, you know, this is challenging, we're going to slow down, blah, blah, blah. No, don't slow down. Like, please, I know it's hard, but watch out.
There are plenty of Americans. There are plenty of Americans who will say that they won't buy a Chinese car. But let me tell you, it's like,
money talks.
Yeah, exactly. If that thing shows up in America with, you know, 300 plus miles of range, and it looks like that, and it's like 30 grand or less, like, money talks. And like, that's going to be the nightmare moment for General Motors and Ford. And it's like, this, that is going to be what really forces their hand. Like, we're seeing that in Europe already, versions of this. And I don't know, it's like, you can do this or it's going to be done to you, you know?
Yeah,
I love the idea though that it's so competitive that it is forcing everyone to like hurry up and make really good products and iterate like rather quickly, considering it takes a long time in the automotive industry to iterate. Yeah. So I mean, I do like that aspect of it, but it's like, ooh, watch out.
Case in point over here, the MG4. Hazel, how many MG4s do you see every day now?
Oh, loads.
There are thousands of them. They're everywhere. It's ridiculous. They're really good. They're great and they're cheap and they are, you know, they do the electric thing for less than Tesla, less than VW. Like, okay, the batteries in some aren't quite as big, and like the tech might not be quite as impressive. But would you rather save money and have a cooler looking car that isn't, you know, the VW ID Cube?
Actually going to be delivered, and they're actually making them.
Yes.
Because the other thing about the MG4 is it's one of the cars that you can get in the UK and you can expect to have a delivery within a year. Like, because there's huge tails on ordering to delivery now. Like, you can be looking at two and a half, 3 years between ordering a car and getting it here. And the thing about the MG4 is you can be like, I would like an MG4. And a month later, you get an MG4. And you can, every day I walk past the charging stations in the car park of the Lidl supermarket near where I live, because I have to go past it to get the bus to work. And, like, there are two MG4s in those charging stations basically every day. And they're different ones. And there's clearly a lot of people buying them, partly because I live in the ULEZ area, so there's an incentive to have an EV, but also because the price is sufficiently low that it is actually competing with all of the horrible cars that people were buying otherwise, like Qashqai and things. With the BYD thing, sorry, I really can't talk this week. I don't know what's going on.
You're sick.
We're all having an amazing time. It's like, Patrick and I had late nights and we're selling Saabs. Hazel's feeling a bit under the weather. Lacey is the freshest face of all of us. Fear not.
The BYD cars are good. These are good technologies. Mm. There is a lot you could point to in that seal, which is better than anything that you could equivalently buy from a US or European automaker. I feel there's very little case that you can make for saying we need to be protected from this, because it's not rubbish technology flooding the market. It's not like, you know, as we've seen with micro e-mobility, where there are lower end products that might have higher associated risk.
Yeah.
But the fact is, if you compare this BYD to other cars available, there is absolutely no reason that this shouldn't be allowed to compete. That is going to cause a problem for automakers, but like, suck it up. Like, this is a problem of your own creation.
Exactly. Yeah,
you didn't do the homework, and the test is coming.
Also, I really like the seal, and like, I absolutely want one. I think it looks so cool.
It's got a stupid name, but other than that, yes. At least it's not an Aura Funky Cat, which is no longer going to be called a Funky Cat.
I wish it was called that.
I love that name.
I love that. And I also love the Aura Cat. I'm sorry. I know everyone's like, oh, it's a bit naff or whatever, but I thought it was really fun to drive.
It's a genuine... The Funky Cat is genuinely a terrible car to drive. It's awful. I hate it. It's got a stupid name. Something with an almost similar... not quite a sillier name, but still quite silly. The next Chevrolet Bolt will be EUV only. As our native Bolt havers... why is this big news, friends?
I wrote this one. I was at the Chevrolet Blazer EV launch, this week. All the drive impressions on the Blazer EV are embargoed for next week. So get excited for that review on Wednesday at Inside EV. I'll tell you, there are things I liked about it and things I didn't like as much. But when I was talking to various folks at Chevrolet, the news came out that the next Bolt, which is having the best sales year it's ever had in 2023. And the sales are up 120% year over year, right in time for GM to cancel it. And then they're like, oh, no, we're not going to cancel it. We're going to bring it back. Just wait. We're going to update it. We're bringing it back, and you're going to love it more than ever. The one that they are bringing back is the Bolt EUV, which is the bigger Bolt, the sort of SUV-like Bolt, not the smaller Bolt EV. Like, that's dead. The next Bolt EUV, it's coming back with Ultium platform, which is going to have, you know, cheaper LFP batteries, better range, better fast charging, which it really needs, and updated hardware. It's going to be the bigger Bolt, which makes sense. Like, I don't think this is news to be like mad about or anything, because that the EUV was outselling the little Bolt 2-1, and it's not much more expensive. I think it's like a Bolt EUV was like $2,000 more, and people were getting Bolts for, you know, mid-20,000s this year. Sometimes like low 30s, but usually less. Like, it was a screaming deal. And like, this proves that that people want affordable cars. They want affordable EVs, that the Bolt did so well. Like, the Bolt and the Model 3 and Model Y are going to be like the sales winners in America by the end of this year. And like, I'm glad GM is smart enough to bring it back. I pray that they keep the price tag intact, and that the next Ultium Bolt EUV is not starting at, you know, $47,000. Like, you know, I hope they get this right, but like, for their own sake. But yeah, this makes a lot of sense. And we'll see if people go for it.
I hope they get this right, coming from the company that every week we've watched make a catastrophic mistake.
See, that's what worries me. Like, because, so for instance, when they launched the 2023, the last iteration of the Bolt, they were really clear that the Bolt's whole thing had been built on using its own architecture, and on getting that price down, and that it would never go to Ultium, because all of the kind of persona of the Bolt, the philosophy of the Bolt, was to do with making it more efficient on this, and that Ultium couldn't do that. And that was GM that said that, not like this was them at their big launch, where they were talking about the efficiencies they'd made over the years with the Bolt. What we're seeing with the Ultium products is, firstly, that they can't make enough of them, and second, and if they're not making enough of them, I imagine that a cheaper car is not going to be the priority for getting the systems out. I suspect that this is going to be a more expensive vehicle, because it will have to be, because Ultium is a more expensive system, and because there will have to be some reworking of the Bolt architecture and the software and everything in order to make it work with an Ultium system. You know, this isn't a trivial swap. So although I'm glad to see them bringing back the Bolt, I don't
have,
it's kind of not a Bolt. It's a Hummer EV in a Bolt dress.
The price tag is going to be a real test of General Motors here, I think. A real test. And it's like, I was driving the Blazer, which, again, driving impressions are embargoed, but some of the ones we were driving were in the $50,000-$60,000 range for like a very large crossover. Not a three-row, but like a pretty beefy crossover. It's like, I just don't know if they're going to succeed on that. Like, they haven't so far. And like, if you could crank out affordable Bolts and win on volume, like, that's a great story. That's proof that they can get this right. But if this thing comes in really expensive and nobody wants it, like, that is just incredibly damning for that company.
Well, it'll be interesting to see because, you know, in the EV lineup that they have, this is going to sit under the Equinox. And they said, oh, Equinox is going to be in the 30s as far as price tag goes. So, you know, maybe that's 35, 39, whatever. But to me, it just seems like they're going to have to raise the price a bit if they are switching to Ultium. But I do like the idea that they're switching to LFP because I think that'll make it, you know, somewhat more affordable for them in that regard. But it'll also be interesting to see if they have more trim options for the powertrain because, you know, the Bolts, they were single motor products. They never had an all-wheel drive variant of it, but that would also bring the cost up. But if they're already knowing that they're going to be getting into that higher price point, then I could see them doing that just to make sense of the extra costs. So I don't know. We'll see. I'm happy to hear that. I like the Bolt a lot, actually. I think it's a great affordable EV. It's just such Same. A shame that it's going away, for especially the time when we have in the 2024 calendar year point of sale for the tax credit. And I feel like this would do so well, even more so than it already is, including with all the other state incentives that people have been capturing with this product.
I always loved this thing. I was a big fan when I first drove it. I think when I was at Jalopnik, I put it on our best cars list in, I think, 2018. And some of my colleagues thought I was crazy, but like, I was right. And like, and they were wrong.
And my colleagues said I was crazy, but I was right. And the boss.
Funny how that works. I always saw the promise of this thing. I thought it was a superb little car. And like, it had a huge following, just like the Volt hybrid did, which they also canceled. And just like the EV1 did, like, which they also canceled. So it's like, I don't know. It's at what point do they start getting this right? Cause I've said this before, I think on here, but like, I think there is a future where GM just says, screw it. And they become a gas truck company. And they just let the Chinese or whoever sell EVs and they make Silverados. And that's all they make. They'll be smaller and less ambitious and less global, but profitable. And, you know, I don't want to see that happen at all. But like the next few years.
And that's a crazy thing to think of, a company that has put all of this money and into these JVs forming Ultium, and not just the car division, but like a wide suite of Ultium products.
Energy, storage and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I know I've said this before, but GM in some ways is like the automaker who I thought was getting this right, who really was thinking about it in this completely holistic way. And I don't understand fully why. I mean, I feel like somewhere in GM, someone needs to sit down and work out where these blockages are. And obviously, you know, yes, there are lots of mitigating factors. The global supply chain crisis, like huge amounts of obstacles in the last 4 years. A lot of things have happened that nobody could reasonably have been expected to predict. I hope they get out of this struggle mode. And I hope that this Bolt EV is a success. But we also have to be realistic about the fact that they are in struggle mode at the moment.
I did see Mary say on the last earnings call that like one of the huge problems that they were having was battery module related. Yeah. So like that was, and to me, that seems so obvious. Like, obviously you're not getting these Ultiums out. Like, what is the deal? It has to be something with the battery pack, or the modules or whatever. So she did confirm that that was like something that they're going to tackle in 2024, but that's been a huge problem for ramping up their EVs.
I tried to get a bunch of folks to talk to me about that exact battery issue at the Blazer launch. Like, what's going on there? It seems to be some sort of like cell assembly automation issue, but like no one.
Yeah, it's the industrial robots, as far as I know.
And nobody would talk about it. Nobody wanted to broach the subject. And then sometimes if you bring up Cruise, the autonomous car division, they would throw a smoke bomb on the ground and shoot into the rafters with a grappling hook gun. But I think the delays and stuff are a very touchy subject, and they're focused on, you know, hyping up the product, but like at some point they got to get the product on the road and in dealers and people buying them, or it's, none of this is going to matter.
Yeah. I mean, you can say, oh, this thing's going to be really good. It's going to be really good. Trust me, it's going to be really good. But eventually you'll just stop believing what is clearly a lie.
I mean, this sort of stuff is complex, and of course the production lines, I think there is an element that GM are trying to make, especially because they have you know, relatively few Ultium factories online right now, and so they're having to make one or two lines try and vary a lot, which probably isn't actually all that practical. Because, you know, you see, for instance, VW, if you go to their Dingolfing plant, then they have like one line making one car's battery and like one line, and that is probably what GM are effectively having to do. But it does mean that some things like cell packaging and stuff, you could try and find efficiencies by trying to do early stages of the production generically. But I suspect that, yeah, these are difficult things to produce. They're dangerous things to produce. They're heavy things to produce, which is why you need industrial robots involved in the process. And industrial robots are very good. They're used in huge amounts of car production. You know, massive companies like ABB or whatever make very, very good robots that can do this kind of thing. It's not that, like, there'll be a complete clown show on the Ultium production floor with, like, robots hitting each other and throwing cells around or whatever. It's
why
just
not?
That, like...
I want robot fights. I want actual things... robot wars.
I'm becoming more and more convinced that we need the reality series of all these automakers.
yeah, we do.
What would the soundtrack to that be? Sorry. I'm just trying to think of a theme tune. We are steadily running out of time. So before we go, let's have a natter about Consumer Reports, because it found, and this might not be a shock to many people, that EPA estimated ranges aren't necessarily achievable for a lot of people. In fact, they drove 22 EVs from full to empty. Half of them are short of the, or nearly half are short of their EPA ranges. They're basically driven constantly at 70 miles an hour, so there's no harsh accelerating or anything like that. It was 70 to 90 degrees Fahrenheit. They found the F-150 Lightning 50 miles short. Lucid Air and Model S were 40 and 39 miles short. Merck EQE 72 miles more, but that's probably because it's shaped like a bar of soap, as well as a few others that did a good. What do we think? I mean, I think it's a test that it's the sort of test that people say, oh, but my EV won't get what it says it should, and they go, yeah, but this is some real life stuff, and here it is. So I thought it's valuable.
Does your gas car get what your gas car says? You know, like, it's just, it's so much more focused on in EVs because the infrastructure is not there, especially on a road trip. But
I mean, on the European side of it, at least, yes, it is focused more on EVs, but that is the selling point of them. This car will go 400 miles. This car will go 300 miles. And, you know, it's when my friend's parents bought a plug-in hybrid, and the, you know, the man in the shop told lovely Clive that it would do 19 or 25 miles on EV alone. And he called me going, it won't do it. Why won't it do it? It's like, well, it's a lab test. So, like, I think it's valuable. Yeah, EVs do get a short shrift because it didn't do what it was supposed to do. But when the selling point is X number of miles.
Well, but I think also, this is unrealistic driving. Sorry, like...
Yes.
Like, something I think is important is that a lot of the range, and you should be including regenerated power within range, like, you shouldn't just be thinking about battery from full to empty, because recovered energy is energy that would be part of the range. So if you are driving at a constant speed and you are not braking, then you won't be recovering anything.
Mm.
Like, you also probably aren't doing a huge amount of lift and coast and stuff like that. So, I don't want to be like a boring nerd here, but I don't feel that this is a realistic test of what the actual range of a car is, because EVs do not work like gas cars. You don't just empty the tank and that's all that you've got. You actually can recover and regenerate that energy, and you should. So... I don't think this is a particularly fair way of doing it. Although I am sort of interested by this, because there was a test that I wrote up a few years ago that was sort of similar, and it was either Consumer Reports or Edmunds. And actually, most of the cars then got massively over their EPA, like colossally over their EPA. So it's interesting if car makers are getting less conservative, because like particularly it was like the Taycan got like an extra 100 miles or something on top of it, like because car manufacturers were being so conservative with the EPA because they didn't want this then like, oh, but it doesn't get it, like, thing.
Well, it's a big issue if they do. Like, I know a lot of people say, well, it doesn't get it. Well, if they are found that they have not met those EPA, like if it gets audited, they will have to pay thousands of dollars back to customers who bought those vehicles, because it's happened before in the past. Like, I worked with Lincoln for a really long time as one of my clients, and that happened when they sold the MKZ hybrid. They were saying and touting it's 45 miles per gallon, and then ultimately it came out that they got audited with the EPA testing, and they had to pay thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars back to owners because of those missed figures. So it is a big penalty if they do that. But one point that Steve brought up in the comment that you just flashed up on the screen here is that, and this is why I always keep saying this, is like 400 miles is not 400 miles if it's rated for 400 miles. So it's like, that's also another point. Like Alex, you just said, like, it's a selling point, but that's what bothers me about it, because you're only charging from maybe down to 10% or so. And then when you consider the winter, when you consider, you know, any of these other elements that you are, you know, coming across, whether that's topography and all these other like driving behaviors and all this, it's like 400 is not 400 actually. Like, and usually you only charge up to maybe like 80% on a daily basis because, you know, you want to prolong the health of your battery. So really 400 is closer down to like, you know, 300. But then if you got winter, you maybe 20% hit on that, depending on how efficient your EV is. So that's why efficiency is so, so, so important, more than like what I think these tests are necessarily, because this just like, I get it. I think there is some value here showing that like, okay, this is like what we did for this extended period of time, and we're going to test these all the same just to show you what we think. But the true thing that is important is like the actual range you're going to get for the use case that you will be utilizing it for. And EPA has many different cycles. So
I think it's a question of like convincing people to buy these things, because like there's folks like us that have been doing this or covering it for a long time and get those nuances. And then I think you have like your 99% of buyers in America who buy like a Honda or Subaru once every 10 years and are looking at some of this stuff and are absolutely terrified of running out of range and are getting stuck, which is something I never hear about. But it's about, you know, Lacey knows this very well. It's like, it's about educating and teaching people that like, yeah, this world's different and that's okay. But it's like, I think they just see this stuff and get really scared off. And to go back to GM a second, when I was talking with Blazer this week, they were talking about this exact thing. It's like, look, we worked really hard to get you like the most accurate range assessment we could, and to make the car's performance, like it is going to, we have to deliver on that, because we are not Tesla. We're not Lucid. We're Chevrolet, and we sell cars to everybody. And like, we have to get this right. And that was really important to them, to be like, if we're going to tell you the car has 300 miles of range, like we're going to do everything we can to get 300 miles of range. Cause like, I just, we're at this point now where it's like, you know, again, to go back to that buyer who buys a car once every 10 years, probably doesn't know anything about how it works beyond oil changes, and like, just is not used to this world and maybe doesn't want to learn. So I don't know how we get over that hump to appeal to everybody, but this is stuff that scares people away when it shouldn't, you know?
That's why it feel like we're in the next step of getting past the early adopters into the mass market, but there needs to be more done to appeal to the mass market. And just like you said, because they aren't like us, they are oblivious to a lot of these things. And it's not to say that they need to learn, but that this should be user-friendly to them. Like, you know, like what do the automakers need to do in order to make this you know, user-friendly experience? And I think NACS was one of the big things automatically that was like, okay, well, I guess we got to do that.
I also think there's we need to, and some of this is on us as like the automotive media. There's things like, you know, the amount of regen that like often it's buried if it's even in the specs at all, like the level of regen that you can get in a car. And the proportion that you could, for instance, get over the course of a battery charge to discharge, which, okay, that's all a little bit technical. Maybe that's not that's the kind of stuff that you know, like, do people actually care how much torque their car has? Probably not a lot of the time. Like if you're the every 10 years buyer, But it's the sort of thing that actually should be in those top specs when you're writing about a car. And also things like efficiency. So like that, how many kilowatts per average 10 miles or whatever, or kilowatt hours. That's the kind of thing that is really relevant. That isn't a metric that we've ever really applied to cars before. Like, but that, well, actually, that's not true. Like, we've always had miles per gallon and things. Like, these aren't things that seem to have translated over.
And if you remember, there was that thing a few years ago in the UK and in Europe where, you know, automotive manufacturers were getting, like, proper stick because their cars weren't quite meeting the published MPG, which is one of the reasons that we switched test cycles over here. NEDC to NEDC to WLTP, because it needed to be, it just needs to change. And WLTP still isn't accurate, like, to the nth degree, but it'll do the job.
Yep.
Anyway, that is our friends. We've run over, which means I sadly can't talk about the new electric Morgan that you can't buy. But
next time, I promise. Week.
Let's do it next week.
I've got actual quotes from an actual man, because
you've been wanting to talk about this for like a month, and I want to give this to you. We'll make this happen for you, Alex.
Next week it's the Goy Morgan Power Hour.
There's not enough to talk about it for an hour, but at least 5 minutes. Anyway, that brings our show to an end. Huge thanks to all of you for listening. Lacey, Miss Go Electric, we love you. Goodbye. Salam. Hazel, we love you. Goodbye. Bossman Patrick, we love you. Goodbye. If you want to get in touch with us, please do so by emailing contact@insideevs.com. And one final big thank you to our producer, Danny Howard, who's been sitting behind the scenes making lots of lovely pictures come up, which is ace. Have a great week, and we will see you next Friday. And I might even wear a Christmas jumper, maybe.
Ooh.
I love that.